You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Remember, we're brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. It's easy. I'm not going to talk about it. Just Google us. We have tons of stuff out there. It's easy to find. So today, we're going to be interviewing M.O. Walsh, who was born and raised in Baton Rouge and whose first novel, My Sunshine Away, is great. We're going to be talking about that. But first, Mr. Walsh has published his stories and essays in such great publications as the New York Times, the Southern Review, American Short Fiction, graduated Ole Miss in the Master of Fine Arts program, lives in New Orleans, where he's the director of the Creative Writing Workshop at the University of New Orleans. So, M.O., thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's nice of you to have me on.
Sure. No, it's great to talk to you because I really love the book. And as I said at the outset, we own an independent bookstore, and your book, as I rearranged it today, is sitting on our front table and doing very well. Yes.
All right. Well, if you wouldn't have done it, I would have snuck in there and tried to do it myself.
Yeah, I definitely straightened out the pile of them.
So sometimes you have to go ninja style in there and move them around, you know?
Yeah, I know. I do it all the time. Well, so, you know, I've read all the reviews. I've read a lot of your interviews. One question I had, and it's because, you know, I went to the University of Florida. One of my professors was Harry Cruz. One of my professors was Paget Powell. But I'm from up here in Philadelphia. And it's interesting. The book has been called Southern Gothic. I wouldn't call it that at all. I wouldn't genreize it at all, as you haven't either. But just a curious question. How do you think the book would have been different had you been, say, a New Yorker or had you been from L.A.? What do you think would have changed in that book, if anything at all?
I mean, it's really hard for me to conceptualize that because, I'm from Baton Rouge, so from the very get-go when I first started it, you know, I felt like it was a place I was very familiar with. But, I mean, if anything would have changed, perhaps, I think it might be the narrator of the book is very kind of, I don't know if defensive is the right word, but he's definitely very aware of the fact that the story has come out of the South, and since it's a dark story with, you know, it's got some crime and a lot of, unsavory aspects to it, he is aware of the fact that he doesn't want to add to this kind of growing literature that comes out of the South, that every story from Louisiana has to be dark and, you know, depressing and swampy and all that. And so, I mean, I think there's some things that would have changed in terms of the way that he relates to the place that he's from and the way that he understands and wants to make sure that readers understand that just because this one thing happened doesn't mean the whole place is bad.
I always think about it like if I imagine Spanish moss in my head, as long as it's not there, I realize, you know, it's a universal book. Well, you know, it's interesting that the protagonist is in, I guess, and I kind of tend to think of this in a Southern sense, he's an innocent, until much later in the book, he's an innocent type person who's unaware of, well, you know, before I go on, why don't you tell us, I do this all the time, why don't you tell us a little bit about the book first and then we can get into some details.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it begins, the first person, you know, narrator telling, the first chapter talks about a crime that took place in his neighborhood. He grew up in a kind of really idyllic suburban neighborhood in Baton Rouge, and one night, a girl that lived across the street from him, she was 15 years old and kind of the, very, very bright, popular, athletic girl, and one night, she was attacked on the street and raped right in their neighborhood, in a very safe place up to that point. And you hear about this in the first chapter, and then the narrator also divulges to you at the end of the first chapter that he was one of the suspects. He was a 14-year-old living across the street from this girl, and his, some people will call it love or obsession or however you want to call it, is kind of what implicates him in this. And so the book kind of starts off that way, where you have a man, he's now in his 30s, talking back about the summer of 1989 when this happened.
It's interesting the way you gave it the perspective of time, because as you've said in some of your interviews, a lot of things, and I know this from personal experience and probably so do you, a lot of the things you do as a child, you kind of become, as you've stated, an unreliable narrator of your own life. And then when you look back at it from the perspective of time, you realize, hey, you know, maybe I didn't do that, or maybe I did this by mistake, or maybe what I thought I did isn't what I really did. Right?
Right. Yeah. And also, I mean, I think what a lot of it is too, is you look back and you, if you think about the way that you thought of things when you're an adolescent, and then now that you're an adult, think about the way that they would appear to other people. I think there's a huge difference. I mean, I've been interested in that idea of, you know, interpretation of what adolescents are doing. You know, I mean, you know, in your mind, you're so, it's the first time you've ever, you know, been that interested in another person, whether it be a girl or boy, whatever. And you just have no idea what to do. And you make choices that in your mind may seem like earnest and like great ideas, and because you're so desperate. And but then, you know, if you're a 40-year-old looking back at a teenager doing those things, they can seem like really bad choices.
Yeah, I know. And the thing really is that he didn't do anything wrong. The activities he engaged in, the actions he took, weren't wrong. He was essentially a child or barely an adolescent. But it's really interesting because the emotions that arise in the reader, you know, involve guilt, regret, which are not, there's no upside to any of those emotions, but we all feel them. And right. It's interesting how you bring those out.
Well, you know, I was raised Catholic, and being raised Catholic, I have to think that there's some upside to guilt, or else it's really a confusing life for me, you know. I think that guilt can be a motivator, you know, in some ways. I think it is in this novel. You know, I mean, I think that there's part of his compulsion just to tell this tale is from guilt, and part of his compulsion to try to make things right, whether or not he can, comes from that too. So you're right that it's not always a good feeling, but I do think that it can be kind of an engine for change sometimes.
Well, if you do talk about it in the Catholic sense, whether the big C or the little C, you know, and I'm not saying the thought is equivalent to the deed, but sometimes he kind of feels that way, the protagonist, the narrator.
Right.
But, you know, you are talking about regret, guilt, remorse, envy sometimes. Yeah, envy, anxiety,
yeah.
Jealousy.
It's your typical day for a teenager.
Yeah, you're right. And and it's you know, that amalgam is kind of what makes you, but at the same time, it's something you have to overcome. Some people never overcome it. And I see what you're saying. I see that what you're trying to say is that, you know, from the synthesis of all these things can come a mature adult who's able to not only forgive himself, but acknowledge what he's done in the past, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I think so. I mean, that sounds good. I mean, I think it's been funny because some people have asked me, you know, well, how did you write, you know, how did you get into the head of, like, you know, an adolescent? It's been funny to me because for two reasons. One, because it didn't seem that hard, you know, at all to think like an adolescent boy. But two, I think it's partly because I'm not really, I mean, the novel is not really in the head of an adolescent yet. The novel is, you know, a man in his 30s looking back at those times and able to kind of, you know, if you're actually in the head of someone, 14, 15, 16, I think that would be some pretty terrifying terrain to write, because there's so little frame of reference, you know, and the narrator is able to kind of go back and pick and choose and look at himself ironically at times and critically at times, which, you know, I think a lot of adolescents aren't able to do in the moment. So there's a big difference to me between a 30-year-old from the narrator and a 15-year-old narrator.
Well, plus, I guess, you know, and first things first, this is not an autobiographical novel, but there are some aspects of the terrain, the locale, maybe some of the people around you that you drew from personal experience, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that neighborhood I kind of mapped out in my head is the one I grew up in. You know, I definitely don't have any kind of one-to-one, you know, characters in real life to characters in the book, but I took people I knew. I think like everyone does. You know, it's not, that doesn't seem a strange thing for me to hear a fiction writer saying they've taken people they know and, you know, turned up the knobs on some of them and exaggerated some things and mixed some people together. And so, but yeah, a lot of the geography I was familiar with, and in the neighborhood for sure, and the time period. You know, I'm only about a year different from the narrator, so I had similar experiences, growing up. So definitely try to draw on the things that I was familiar with.
You know, it's funny is how Lindy was like 1 year older than him, but back then, I mean, I skipped one grade, so I was always behind, which like really hurt me with girls too. But but it is funny how 1 year back then is like 10 years now, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, totally different, like, social stratosphere, you know?
Yeah.
Everything is different.
Was there someone, well, for me, I could definitely identify with the protagonist, because there was someone like Lindy for me, someone who I really thought was unobtainable, but who I really thought was the kind of person I'd like to be with, that kind of person. Was there someone like that for you when you were younger?
Well, I mean, I was always, like, a romantic kid. Even from, you know, my parents will tell stories of me, like, in the fourth grade, like, begging them to, you know, take me to a store so I could buy, like, a little plastic ring for a girl. I'm sure I didn't know my name, you know?
Oh, I did the same thing.
Absolutely. That doesn't surprise me. Look, we both went and, like, got writing degrees.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me. I think there's romantics in a lot of fiction writers, for sure. But you know, I was always kind of that way. But out of all the characters in the book, you know, Lindy is really like the largest invention. You know, I mean, I don't really have any particular person I modeled that after. You know, I had heard a story from my when I was young from my neighborhood about that happening to a girl, but I had no idea what it was. I never asked, even when the book came out. I never talked to my folks about it to get any clarification. I don't feel like it's my right to do that. But so she's a total invention. But that idea of having someone, you know, that you just desperately want to return your attention is that's familiar. That's familiar to me, as I'm sure it is to many people.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the ring I got for this girl, like, was a skull and crossbones with two fake rubies for the eyes. Big mistake.
Yeah, I bet you thought she would have dug it. You know?
I did.
We just tried so hard.
You know? You do your best. Well, one of the things that is on par with your protagonist is that when you heard that story from your mom, and when the protagonist hears it, you really didn't know what the concept of rape, of violation, was. It didn't reverberate in you as you didn't know what the word meant, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I have no idea how old I actually was. I don't know if that matches up, but you know, when thinking about the narrator, I don't think that people were, you know. I don't know. I don't think that people were more necessarily uninformed or ignorant or things like that. But definitely we didn't have the same focus as, you know, as 14-year-olds then as people do now when they have the internet, you know. And it's, you know, we weren't Googling things that we didn't understand. You know, there was just lots of stuff you didn't understand. But you had other interests and you went off and you did that and you listened to music on your tape deck or, your CD player or whatever. And so I think it was different. You know, I mean, I think there's, you know, people have asked me, like, well, how did he not know, you know,
right,
what rape was when he was 14 years old? I'm like, well, easily. It didn't come up, you know? So I do think there's a difference there.
I remember when I was 14 and I didn't know what the word sperm meant. I thought it had to do with the sperm whale. And then everyone started laughing at me when they explained what it was. It was very embarrassing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, the narrator talks about that in the book. I mean, he can remember certain words that he came across in his life, like prophylactic is one of them, you know. like, what in the world could that have been, you know? Just in words like that just have a certain power, you know. They sound interesting, you don't know what they mean, and so many possibilities.
Yeah, I know. It's very true. But like you said, and this segues nicely into one of your interviews where you talk about people losing their wonder. And I agree with that wholeheartedly, because there's just so much information pouring in. And you were talking about Google, and I read these studies where it says half the studies say our brains are being enhanced by Google. Half the studies say we're losing, they're atrophying. In fact, there's a recent study that says that kids are losing the ability to recognize facial expressions of other people because they interact so little face to face.
Oh, that's pretty scary. That's just kind of sociopathic or something.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I went out to a restaurant the other night, a family of five, and they weren't talking. The mother and father were on their cell phones, and the girls had their phones beneath the table like girls always do, looking down. And it was just sad. It was very sad. They weren't a family anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of become interested in it, you know, especially while you know, while writing the book, and people would kind of ask me, you know, about kind of like research process and what am I doing and things like that. And I felt like it was important for me not to, like, you know, do a bunch of crime research or do a bunch of, you know, that type of stuff, and instead just write from memory and, you know, and embrace the kind of failings that memory has, and also the kind of wonderful edits and revisions that, you know, memory does. And this is like the most human thing that we have, you know. And so I have become interested in it when I see people just immediately going for an answer rather than enjoying the process of thinking and having the kind of courage to be wrong, you know, which I don't think people really have as much anymore. You know, they go find the data and that's the answer and the conversation's over. I just kind of think it's nice when you go back and five people sit around thinking and, you know, five of them come up with five different answers, and that's kind of an interesting human moment, you know?
Yeah, you're right. And it doesn't really make any difference whether you have the right answer. It's the dialogue, and the dialogue is what's suppressed. And what you talk about in your interviews is, I guess, dealing with your own students in your classes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I'm lucky enough to teach, you know, graduate students, so they're older and they're very, you know, dedicated and smart and stuff, but they definitely already, you know, I mean, these are people in their, I'm only in my, you know, upper 30s, and they're in their mid-20s, and there's a really big difference, I think, just the kind of way that we approach information and things like that. So I've become interested in it for sure.
Yeah, and it's only gonna, it's, you know, it's such a dynamic area. It's only gonna change.
Oh yeah.
At a quicker pace, well, actually.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Well, I guess that's getting a little bit away from the book, but the one thing we were talking about, and I don't know if you know the book by Julian Barnes, which is The Sense of an Ending. And
you know, I've not read this book, but I've heard about it. It looks awesome.
It is, and your book kind of is kind of like it in a sense, because it's about a letter that a guy writes when he's in his teens. And as he grows older, he feels like the letter was maybe not the best letter, but wasn't that bad. But then as he gets towards the end of the book, he's thinking, well, maybe it was bad. And then he finally gets a copy of the letter, and he's appalled at what he wrote. And it has dire consequences that he didn't know that he actually caused. And it resonated with me when I read your book as well.
That's great. I'm glad.
Yeah, you would. I think you would really enjoy it. It's actually not. It's like not a fun read, but it's a very profound read, and you do identify with it just as you did with your protagonist. But I don't know. It's like I guess with Lindy and with some of the other characters in there. At times, there's a part of me that was thinking, well, is this protagonist reliable? Can we rely on him telling the truth? Because all we know is what he knows. And I wonder whether that entered your mind, or was it a conscious thing to let the reader guess, or am I just totally off base?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I definitely felt, you know, without giving too much away about, you know,
right,
about what happened in the book, I mean, I definitely felt like the whole time I was telling it, even if I didn't know exactly, you know, like in the, maybe the, you know, the second year I was working on it, I did not know what was going to happen several hundred pages down the road exactly in terms of plot. But I always kind of knew what the core of the narrator was and the drive for telling. And so whenever I think a lot of the you know, kind of suspenseful or unreliable moments are due to his awareness of the whole story and making sure that he can get the whole story out before he gets that, maybe that crucial piece of information that the reader wants out. Because if he just goes straight to that, you know, again, that's the idea of just going straight to the answer instead of having the conversation, it's going to be looked at in the wrong way, you know? And so I think a lot of that, you know, with foreshadowing, if you want to call it that, is simply his knowing the whole story and his being able to kind of, you know, string it out the way that he wants in order to get all the details that he wants in before he gives you the final resolution, or if there is one.
Yeah, I guess, you know, now that you did talk about Roman Catholicism, I guess in some ways it almost is like a confessional, isn't it? I mean, kind of.
Yeah, I see it that way, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely, you know, it's. I mean, it's been really nice because, you know, people have commented on, like, the plotting and the pacing and the mystery and all type of stuff. And when I tell you, I mean, I have really zero background and writing about mystery. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, we typically, you know, I'm guessing you wrote literary short stories at Florida. I'm guessing you're, you know, working on literary novels.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the same as me. And so what's been interesting to me is people comment on that and ask me, like, well, who are your models? And I mean, I have like zero. And it was, I think, typically what it, I think really what it was is that all the momentum of the story to me was coming out of this narrator's need to confess to something, you know, that kind of compulsion. Like I said, he's like, he's got to tell the story. And that to me is the urgency. And so I feel like everything else plot-wise was the result of him rather than going the other way where people would ask me, well, how did you plot it out? I'm like, well, I just knew he needed to tell it, you know? And that's what really kind of gave it the, at least a hope, gave it some energy.
Well, that's what's good about a story is that if you kind of intuit or know the ending, it makes, I think Neil Gaiman talks about this, how it makes it so much easier. You have to write because you know you got to get to the ending that you already know. And that's a good process as well. Go ahead. Sorry.
I just because absolutely, it's like so hard to write that middle part. Yeah, it's like you know your beginning and you might know your ending, but oh man, there's like 200 pages of middle. It can be kind of tough.
Yeah, and the thing about the middle is you don't want to go off. You know, you don't want to go off somewhere else.
Although you have to keep it interesting in the middle. I mean, that's when I don't know. You know, talking about students and stuff and. You know, or just talking to people about novels versus short stories. I might have even agreed with this before I actually finished a novel, but people always say, well, God, it's got to be so nice in a novel because you got so much more elbow room and you can do all this type of stuff. And I just think that is totally untrue. I mean, I felt just as kind of pressure-packed on my paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter in the novel as I did in stories. You know, I mean, just because you're in the middle of a novel doesn't mean you can suddenly become boring, you know?
Yeah.
So I found that interesting when people are saying, oh, it must have been nice to have so much extra room. And I did not feel that way at all.
Well, when you do take an aside, it is very interesting. For example, and you can talk about this a little, you have in your interviews too, is about the difference between Baton Rouge and New Orleans and why that's important to you, why it was important to you growing up and, you know, Katrina and all that stuff. Why don't you tell a little bit about that? Because it seems to be important to you.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's important to me in a couple of different ways. As a person from Baton Rouge, the subject in general was important to me because, you know, Baton Rouge was intensely affected by Katrina, and not nearly in the way that New Orleans is. But it's not a contest. I mean, it's just it was really totally changed. You know, I mean, demographics just absolutely changed overnight, and it's still been affected by it. And not many people have ever. I don't think really heard that story. And there's other cities that could tell similar stories too. So there's that part of it that was interesting to me as a person and then interesting, I think, to the narrator because he's from Baton Rouge and has experience with it. But then there was the part that was important to me in the book is that the chapter to me, again, without giving too much away, is really just, to me, like an extended metaphor. It's like the longest metaphor I've ever written. I spent months and months of my life on it. Just kind of him thinking about Baton Rouge and New Orleans and him thinking about himself and this girl, Lindy. When I went, my editorial process was really great. I mean, there weren't really any sort of, you know, arguments or fights that you hear about between writers and editors. And there was a slight suggestion that, you know, perhaps I think about cutting that chapter because it does seem like it gets off the plot and, it's all this type of stuff. And it was mentioned to me, well, you know, I'm just kind of concerned that the only people that would care about this chapter are people from, you know, Baton Rouge, you know, and I'm like, well, that's exactly why it must be here. You know, I mean, this is where the guy's from. It's incredibly important to him. You know, like I said, they were very, you know, I think once I made my case, they're like, okay. And what's been interesting to me is that a lot of the feedback I've gotten just even anecdotally and in interviews has been about that chapter. And it's been positive, you know, it's been people saying, well, I didn't know that. I didn't realize it happened in Baton Rouge. Or it's even people from New Orleans saying, yeah, you know, it was good to hear people talk about that because we are really close to each other, an hour away, you know, with two biggest cities in Louisiana. But it's there's a strange relationship between the two of us.
And
It struck me as worth talking about.
Yeah, it's like you're the redheaded stepchild or something like that. Almost. But, you know, it's really what's really funny is me having gone to the University of Florida, and without giving anything away, there's a sporting event involved in the book.
That's right.
And I was at that game.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And it was a really strange game. But the other thing that's really funny is that my daughter, who's now 32, went out on one date with Tim Tebow.
Oh, man.
She's still kind of in love with him, I think. I hope she doesn't hear this. But
that's funny, but that's, you know, things, I mean, you definitely recognize it, and I'm sure, you know, people in Philadelphia may feel similarly about, you know, Eagles games and stuff like that. I have no idea, but in these college towns, man, I mean, everyone remembers, like, exactly where they were for, like, particular games like that, you know?
Yeah, that one especially.
Yeah, absolutely. It just becomes part of, like, your, you know, the lore of your life, you know, of your town. It's just interesting. It doesn't surprise me at all that you were there.
And also, I used to go to a lot of the LSU games because they were important games, but you guys came away from that game with a lot different feeling than I did.
Yeah, but it's gone back and forth plenty enough.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it's great. And that was something that was a lot of fun to write about, because that's been something that's important. It's been important to me my whole life, you know, just sports and, you know, growing up in a college town and giving so much of your time and energy to, you know, the local team. And it's funny because I guess there's part of me that kind of worried about scenes like that in, like, a literary novel, you know, like a football scene and a high school house party scene and things like that. Well, one of my old professors actually wrote me today, and it's like, man, I heard you were doing a guitar solo scene at a house party. I never thought you could pull that off in a novel. He said, but you did, you know. And I think there's some sort of concerns about everyday kind of, you know, high school things or sporting events being worthy of literary novels, but they are, man. They're so important, you know.
Oh yeah, I think they're seminal I think that chapter was kind of pivotal. I mean, it was pivotal in the novel. Because it gave the protagonist revelations about character that he wouldn't have received otherwise. Mm-hmm. And also he was able to enjoy for a brief moment limelight that he otherwise hadn't seen before too.
Right. Yeah. That real rare thing, you know, for a high school kid, you know, kind of a moment of control, you know, controlling the room. Feels good.
I kind of wanted him to keep it up, you know? That was kind of rude, which is good. You know, it's good you have a reader, not just me, but a reader in general who says, yeah, let's keep on, you know, because, you know, it's certainly up to you.
I think that advice goes for lots of things with writing. You know, I mean, one of my old teachers, Tom Franklin, on this always gave the advice. He's like, hey, if you're ever invited to read for 15 minutes, you read for 12.
Good point.
That was the advice. Yeah, that was the advice. I've always kind of taken that page too, you know, like don't ever say you're welcome, you know, be as good as you can be and get on out.
Yeah, I think there was a Seinfeld episode where George was talking about leaving on a high note, and it's definitely true, and you can go on a little bit too much. Well, say, you know, you mentioned that when you were a year into the novel, I mean, it's interesting. Why don't you talk a little bit about how long it took to write and how you were interrupted by family matters and things like that?
Right, yeah. Yeah, well, altogether, you know, from sitting down with that first chapter to, you know, when I'd sent it out and it had been accepted and we had, you know, edited it, it was about 7 years. And so the last maybe 6 months of that were with a publisher, but all the rest of it was just with me and really not showing it to anybody. Just a couple of friends I showed the first 50 pages to, and then one writer at a writer's conference I showed the first 52. But other than that, it was me, and it was partly because I just work really slowly. I think my process is like kind of, you know, backward and not very smart. But it's just a kind of constant revision over and over and over again to the point of maybe it's kind of obsessive. I don't know. So it took me a long time just to get moving. I mean, I would work, you know, like I told you, I worked on short stories for so long that I was always used to starting on page one and going through the whole story and revising as I went, you know, and just getting to the end, but revising the whole time. And working on a novel, I mean, I was 60 pages in before I had to stop starting on page one every time I sat down to work. You know, I just wanted to revise and read everything. But the problem was I would work for like 4 hours, you know, and write one sentence and I'd be done for the day. I'd have one new sentence. And so I think that's part of what took so long. And then I had to really change my writing habits. My wife and I had two children during the process, a 6-year-old girl and a 2-year-old boy. And, you know, I, uh, that just changed everything. I just had to, I started waking up. Before, they would get up, so my kids always get up at 6, so I would start waking up at 4 and write from 4 to 6, because as soon as they enter my day, I just feel like I'm not as good on the page.
That's you know? It. It's interesting that you say you like... In one of the interviews, you talk about actually liking the revision process better, which I haven't heard from authors.
Oh, I like it much better.
Really?
Much better. And maybe that's, you know, there's part of me that thinks that maybe that's like cowardice on my part.
Why?
I mean, because you're, you know, the first draft to me feels like, I don't know, just, I mean, it's like moving ahead feels like really painful for some reason. Maybe it's because you're going out on a limb so much and creating new and willing, and you have to be willing to perhaps write things that aren't going to go anywhere, and you have to be willing to make mistakes, you know, when you're moving ahead and all that type of stuff. But revision to me feels like, you know, it feels like joy. I mean, revision feels like, you know, putting the puzzle together, because I know I've got all the corner pieces and I've got all the edges, because I'm looking at what I've already written and I can work inside of that. And that just feels like a lot of fun. It feels really rewarding to try to get sentences the best, to try to get paragraphs the best that I can make them. That's a lot of fun. Moving out into the void is not as much fun to me. I don't know why. Like I said, maybe I'm just maybe it's cowardly, or maybe it's kind of just an obsession of tidying things up rather than inventing things.
No, I think it's. I definitely think it's healthy. It's just that most writers seem to like think of revision as just like homework. And you're looking at it as a chance, yeah, as a chance to like.
That's the revision is the prize for me. Yeah,
that's so cool.
That's the, yeah, it's a lot. I think it's a lot of fun. I mean, I'd much rather do that. And I don't think I was always that way. I mean, I think I was definitely, you know, like most people are. Like when I was an undergrad, there was nothing cooler than like going to the bar and drinking and coming home and like inventing a story and writing the whole thing in one night. You know, feeling like a genius. You know, that was a lot of fun. You know, like I said, now I have a little bit more fun polishing things rather than inventing them.
Well, the book,
not to say that it's not fun at all. It is, and it's rewarding. But I like revising.
Well, as a bookseller, and I tell this to a lot of my authors, you know, as many people as you can tell don't judge a book by its cover. Everyone who comes into my bookstore does, and your cover is attractive, and people gravitate towards it. But then that leads also to the other thing I'm always fascinated with, and you've been asked 1,000 times, is about the epigraph, which follows the title of the book, and it's the first verse of "That Please Don't Take My Sunshine Away." And you talk about that in terms of the whole song. If you take it as a whole concrete song, it's not as happy as the epigraph makes it sound, right?
Right, that's correct, yeah. You know, the chorus, I think, is what most people are familiar with. You know, "You're my sunshine, my only sunshine." You hear kids singing it and all that type of stuff. And you know, especially down here, it was written by Jimmy Davis, or they say written. He performed it, and, you know, I don't know if he actually wrote it or if he just bought it and has the credits for it. But anyway, he would you know, stomp around the South singing that song as his campaign song. And he was the governor twice and became the state song of Louisiana. And so when you're a kid, you learn it, you know. I mean, like my daughter knows it now. She learned it in pre-K, you know. And you know, and so it's like part of the culture here, and everyone loves that song. But everyone just sings the chorus, and the chorus sounds happy enough. But you know, the verses are really just a lot of sadness in them. And, you know, about a guy not wanting a person to leave him, and then there's another verse about you know if you don't love me back, you will regret it one day. And it's kind of menacing, strange verse, you know. And so when I got older and kind of started to know the song a little bit more, it just struck me that was similar to the way the novel was working, in terms of a narrator looking back at something that on the surface of it would seem like a very kind of idyllic suburban neighborhood and youth, but once you actually start looking at what's going on, it becomes much more complicated and dark. And so it made sense to me in that way.
I guess that's true of a lot of things in America and everywhere, but yeah, I think it was, you know, it was a good idea putting that in there, because it does, you know, it's there it is, but it does leave a lot unsaid as well. But, you know, and I was looking at your influences and things like that, but what struck me, because it's so popular in my store, is that the fact that you're reading All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
Yeah, I recently finished that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like so funny, because we've sold so many copies of that book, and what I've come to do now is just anyone who comes in looking for a book, I just give them that book and I say, if you don't like it, bring it back. And no one has brought it back. And,
I was super impressed by that book. I'm always impressed by anything that takes the amount of just imaginative effort that book took in terms of, you know, just research and recreating it and just the scope of the story. And I mean, it's just so impressive to me that people put so much of their lives and work into something like that. But also just the writing I thought was incredible, and just the whole, the take on it. I mean, the design of the book, it was amazing. And all the little, you know, little chapters are just like crystals to me. I mean, it was an impressive, impressive book.
It really was. And it's gotten so much accolade, which he says he never expected, but it really is. You know, it's funny, and I don't know whether you would ever consider doing this. And actually, you could have almost done it in this book. Is, you know, sometimes you get a book and you see that each chapter is another from another character's viewpoint, and you go, oh no, what if I like one character better and I don't want to read that chapter? But the way they all came together and the consequences of one person's actions and how they can reverberate throughout, you know, so far, do you think you could ever write in such a way? Like, you know, you have four suspects, you have basically two big protagonists. Would you have ever considered, or would you consider in the future, writing a book in which you were... there were two voices and alternating chapters or something like that?
I like all the different strategies, you know. I mean, even, you know, one of my favorite books is As They Lay Dying, you know, which is really attacks things from different angles. And I like it all. I mean, anything, you know, the truth of the matter, as you know, man, anything that's done well is good. You know, I don't have any sort of bias all the way against any sort of manner of telling a story. I mean, it's the type of thing where when it comes at you and it's excellent, it's obvious, there's nothing else to say about it other than to applaud and be thankful that someone took the time to do that, you know? So I definitely, all bets are on. I mean, I'd be willing to try anything as long as I thought it best suited the story, and, you know?
The thing about it, As I Lay Dying and all of Faulkner's work is it's just so... when I read it, it's just like so dense to me, you know, it's so, there's so much in there that it's really hard for me to access it. I have, and then the results are wonderful, but it's really hard to, you know, you can dive into your book, you can dive into Anthony Doerr's book, but it's really hard to dive into Faulkner, as opposed to, say, Hemingway or Steinbeck.
Right. Yeah.
But I was going to ask you something else about... I guess classifying books into a genre. When you first, like, I'm not familiar with mystery books either, and it wouldn't strike me to call this a mystery book in the slightest. It's more of a psychological, not a thriller, but it's more of a psychological viewpoint of one person and that the personal growth of that one person. But what you're saying is, again, referring back to Neil Gaiman, is that He has his webpage or a blog where people write him letters and they say, oh, I don't know whether to do this in the first person or the third person. How should I go about getting to the ending and all that? And he always writes back just what you said, which is just write it. Just write it and it'll come out the way it comes out. And don't worry so much about the rules, because the rules really aren't that important and don't apply to you. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it, which appears to be the way you look at it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I definitely think there's, you know, as far as like the teaching aspect of writing, I mean, I'm typically looking at the sentences themselves, you know, and you know, are you doing the best you can sentence by sentence, and then other large kind of ideas. I'm interested, you know, in why people are writing certain stories. I mean, do they actually care about it, you know, or is it just, you know, something that they jotted down, you know, 30 minutes before class or whatever. And that usually tends to, usually the success of the story has a relationship to how much they care about it. You know, that's kind of obvious. But other than that, it really is the type of thing where I've been surprised by tons of different types of stories. You know, it's a weird thing. It's like when you get it right, it's like the point of view, the tense, the tone, the language, everything just comes together, and it's not something I don't think that you can always map out beforehand.
No,
you know, it's like the type of thing that it's just a stroke of luck lots of times. But the more you practice it, and the more you listen to people to know what they're doing and are trying to help you, the more you can recognize, I think, when things are working. You know, the more you can kind of start to recognize your own strengths.
Yeah, I think
I see that happen with students.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, whether you're making a movie or writing a book or building a house or doing a piece of art, I think if you have a vision in your head beforehand, and then very seldom, but sometimes that vision manifests itself in the reality you've created, it's like this moment of, not pride, but this moment of like, wow, that's amazing that I was able to do what was in my head. And I think that's very important. But what are your students thinking, like, you're a big cheese now? Are they all in awe of you because of this?
I don't think so. I mean, nothing's really changed as far as that goes. I mean, I think that they think I have a lot of, crusty rules and stuff, and I just like to I like to tell them that everything can be better than it is, you know. But I'm just trying to help them out, man. I went to Ole Miss, and one of my main teachers there, my thesis director, was Barry Hanna, and he was quite a, you know, I don't know if your readers know him or not, but
I do. I love
really
him.
Really, just a force of nature, you know, and so I learned a lot from him being hard on me, you know, and I took it as a challenge, and so I don't know any way to teach other than trying to return the favor that was done to me, which was that kind of constant nudging of, you know, this can be better, you know, you can do better. And that just inspired me. I think there's some people when they hear, they knock themselves out, they do their best, they give it to someone, and the person, if they don't praise them, you know, there's some people that just collapse and they're done. I don't think those people make it very far in terms of, you know, having a career as writers. I mean, I think the people that turn something in, they did their best on, and they don't, you know, they, someone tells them, hey, this can be better, or hey, this isn't any good. Well, they say, you know, all right, well, thank you, I appreciate it. And then in their mind, they're thinking, you know what? I can, you know, I'm going to go back and I'm going to show you, you know? You know, I think there's this kind of competitive spirit to writers, the ones that stick to it and make it, you know?
That's very true. I mean, you can feel trod upon by constructive criticism, or you can take it as a challenge. And I guess that's what boils people down, you know? You go one side or the other. And, you know, and it's not like it's tough love or something like that, but I think if you approach your students like you probably do and do it the way you do, I think it's probably very encouraging. It must be a little tough, though, that you're so close in age to them. You know?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any – I mean, I will joke with them sometimes. You know, like if I know that there's a student walking into a class that is going to, the workshop, the story is going to have some, you know, some difficulties, I'll tell them, you know, well, put your helmet on, you know, before you walk in, because it's about to get rough. But I think that they all understand that I don't get joy out of making people feel bad. I mean, I don't try to do that intentionally. I mean, I get joy out of trying to get these writers to be the best versions of themselves that they can, which is often, you know, a remarkable writer. You know, I mean, we've got a lot of great students, and so it's you know, that's, I think they know where I'm coming from, so I don't think they take it so personally.
Okay, well, I think that ends it on a high note.
We're good.
So thank you so much for coming by today, and also since we do have our bookstore, and it's I think it's a great one. When a book comes out in paperback, if you ever end up coming up this way, which I did, although I still don't know why I did, but if you ever come up this way, come on in, and you could do a signing, or we could just get a drink, or it would be great. You could come by the store anytime.
Well, that would be great. And one of my best friends is also a writer. It's from Philadelphia. A guy named Sean Ennis. Got a story called Chase Us out. You should check it out. Good. It's a collection of stories, and I would love to go. It's all Philadelphia stuff. And I would love to go up and see some of that stuff. He's a guy that I know more about Philadelphia from reading his stories than anything else. So I'd like to come to Philly and check it out.
What's his name again?
Sean Ennis, S-E-A-N. Last name is E-N-N-I-S.
Oh, I think I've heard of him. Okay, well, definitely...
He's really good.
I'll definitely stock his book, and I'll give him a call and see if he wants to come out and do a signing, too.
Oh, great. Yeah, give him a call.
Well, thanks.
And, any chance I could go to, like, an Eagles game, too?
Maybe. We'll see what happens in this year.
Yeah. All right, man. Well,
okay.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mo.
That was great.
See
ya.
Bye-bye. So that was M.O. Walsh talking about his book, My Sunshine Away, which is kind of like a mystery, even though he says it isn't and I say it isn't. But it does involve, you know, a tragic situation of rape, and then four suspects, of which the protagonist is one. And then it unfolds along until you actually figure out at the end what I guess you can figure out what you figure out. But the book is more of a psychological journey of the protagonist as he goes forward, remembering what he did, living it as he does it, and then trying, I guess, synthesize the two into what happened, which then makes him the person that he becomes some 20 years later. So in any event, that was a pleasure talking to Emma Walsh. So continue to join us every week on The Avid Reader. We got a whole bunch of really good stuff coming up. We have tons of authors in the pipeline. We just met with pretty much every publicist from Penguin to Random House to Doubleday to Morris to Workman, a whole bunch of them. They had this thing in New York. It was called Speed Dating. And what it was you pitched your bookstore to each publisher for about 12 minutes and then moved down the line to the next one. And I think we did very well, and I think a lot of the people already know us because, you know, as I've told you before, we're up to around 200 authors. So we got lots of good things coming down the pike, thanks to Rebecca, my producer. And thanks to you, as always, for making this happen, for keeping us going. And check us out. Like I said, Wellington Square Bookshop, all you got to do is Google the name and you'll come up with all our different outlets. And I'm not going to say any more about our website, our Facebook, or anything like that because we are really close to the top at Google and almost all the social organizations that we've joined and participate in. So thanks as always, and we will talk to you and a great author again next week here on The Avid Reader.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.